He waited for some thanks. He hadn't killed her. He delivered her to safety. Safety as far as she knew. She was failing his test, big time. For the first time, she glanced at the truck's visor, at a wallet-sized photo taped there. It showed a woman smiling. "Pretty," she said. "Your wife?" He looked at the picture of his wife, Roxanne, smiling down on them in the murky green glow of the dashboard lights. He said, "No." He said, "My sister." Without a word of gratitude, the woman swung open the passenger door and stepped out. She looked at him and opened her mouth to speak. Her eyes kept darting to the gate. Bugs spiraled and flitted in the twin cones of light. The gate glowed white, as phosphorus burning, with blackness as solid as a wall on the other side. A wolf howled medium close by. Her eyes snapped back to him. "Where in Canada?" Dawson made a show of lifting one hand, pulling back his shirt sleeve, and looking at his wristwatch. It was after midnight. If she thanked him in the next minute, he might not let her wander off to her doom. Another howl split the night. "Okanogan Valley," he told her. He described pretty little houses and orchards filled with cherry trees, gardens and lakes. He assured her that once she'd passed through the gate, she'd qualify as a political refugee, and they'd have to provide her with shelter and a fresh start in life. He could let her last thoughts be a comforting fantasy. She should stumble into the dark expecting to find love and acceptance. Once that wolf pack caught up with her, not long after he'd driven away, she'd wish she'd died on adjustment day. The academic, Ramantha, she stood beside the truck. She pulled something from a pocket of her coat and leaned in to place this gift on the seat beside him. Paper something. In the dim light, it was old money. Useless trash. "For your trouble," she said. She belted the coat tight around herself. "Leave your headlights on," she ordered. "At least until I get through." In quick, resolute steps, she marched away. Centered in the lights, her shadow loomed in front of her, towering and terrible. Each step raised dust that floated in her wake. She turned out just like the others, a selfish, gutless tribe who considered just their own self-interests. She wasn't the first. Dawson had brought others here. The first was a journalist who'd managed to escape adjustment day, tweed something, a television reporter. The second had been another think tanker, a doctor, Dr. Ashanti, a therapist with a 500,000 votes to his name on the list. Both had charged off into the darkness in expectation of the warm embrace of like-minded liberal progressives. A third had been some dude, a city councilman from Seattle. Each of the three had gone through the gate without so much as a good night. Afterward, Dawson had killed his headlights and sat listening. Each night the howling had found them before they could find their way back to his truck. He'd heard them crashing through the briars and scrub, and he'd heard them screaming. Never his name, because none of them had ever asked his name. They'd only shrieked for help, for someone to help them, for someone to save them. They'd screamed, "Mister!" And they'd screamed, "Please!" And in the end, they'd only screamed. This one, Ramantha, was halfway to the gate. Dawson had the same thought each time. Instead of letting the wolves shred this one, he considered gunning the truck's engine, dropping it into third gear and peeling out. He could run her down, take her ear. A mercy killing. A win-win benefiting everyone once the wolves found her corpse. He slid a hand into his pocket and played with the wedding ring hidden there. Home waited. He hadn't been home all season. He'd spent his youth being a good husband and a model employee on the shop floor. Sure, now he was a chieftain. If he wanted, he could have a passel of wives, rule over multitudes. But that just looked like a bigger version of the same trap. As a ruler, he'd have to be a good husband to more women. And a king amounted to being a model employee with countless people to look after. His fingertips felt the round, hard, closed circle of the wedding ring. That's why he'd been on the road this long. He discovered he had the soul of a barbarian, a warrior. And winning was death to that spirit. He wanted a new army and new battles. Winning was fine, but not half as rewarding as fighting. That's why the testing. To find just one person to serve as his accomplice, a partner to help him keep the adventure of his life going. It could be that he'd lived at the bottom of the heap for too long. He could only savor the fight. His constitution wasn't compatible with peace and leisure. Whatever side had the uphill battle, that's the side Dawson wanted to join. The figure of the fugitive academic receded into the distance. Her shadow against the gate was almost the same size as her. The headlights blazed, turning her back into one blank white shape of a human. Her shadow was the black version of the same shape. And in another step, these two opposing shapes would touch. He hadn't wished this for the others, but tonight Dawson willed for her to stop. His hand hovered above the center of the steering wheel, ready to honk the horn, to warn her. Still, he knew there was no point in saving her unless she was worthy. Whispering, he begged her to stop, to come back, to join him on his next campaign, whatever that would be. He yearned to be a force for change, not a landlord. His wife wouldn't starve. She'd continue to receive his allotment of Talbot bucks, an income sufficient to maintain her hundreds of dependent servants. As a small sacrifice, he rolled down his window. His fingers produced the ring from his pocket, and he lifted it toward the space open above the glass. He let it drop, and it fell, bouncing once against the outside of the door. A tiny chime. Then it was lost. At the chime, the woman froze in place. One hand it reached out to touch the latch, and this blazing white hand touched the fingertips of her shadow hand. Then both hands pulled away from each other. She turned and began walking back. The wolves howled closer, and Dawson laid on the truck's horn to scare them away. He leaned across the seat and pushed open her door. She climbed in. "I can't," she said, her voice flat with resolve. Her arms folded across her chest, she said, "I can't just give up and forge a new life. Not for all the maple syrup in the world." It wasn't fear of the wolves. The woman had changed. She glared into the night. "I can't let the bad guys win. I can't ditch my ideals." She turned to meet his gaze, her eyes blazing. "Gender studies is a real thing, and I won't let it be a lost cause, not if I have to fight back with every drop of my blood." Fury clouded her face, her frail hands clenched into stony fists. In a voice hoarse with vengeance, she rasped, "People should read bell hooks." Dawson had been wrong. She'd passed his test. She was a fighter. A keeper. Her face softened. "Where are my manners?" she said. "I never thanked you." She offered her hand. "Please, tell me your name." At that he told her, "Dawson," and turned the key to the truck's ignition. Miss Jo had taken to reading the Talbot book. It held that the act of storytelling was essentially digestive in nature. We bring up a topic, much like how a ruminant animal, a cow for example, brings up partially masticated grass from its stomach. In our stories, we exhaust our emotional attachment to past events. We elicit similar stories from others. By mulling things over, and the word mulling meant to grind, just as ruminate meant to think, we are able to assimilate the most unhappy or happy experiences of our lives. We accept them as normal human events. We quit telling them, and the stories become part of us. Miss Joe. She'd been recounting the glory of her family and race for so long that she had white fatigue. The Talbot book claimed that mankind was suffering from identity fatigue. People were living too long to retain a single self. Therefore, the boldest were seeking a new frontier. Men were becoming women. Whites were becoming blacks. Dawning on Miss Joe was the fact that she was the culmination of a long line of rebels and pioneers. She was the last of her breed, and she was bone-tired of repeatedly giving lip service to her illustrious family history. Her family had outlived its glory. Its stories could die with her. The story of her life was a tasteless mouth of mush. She rose from her chair and moved around the room, turning off the lamps. In complete darkness, her fingertips found the candle and the matchbook on the lace doily on her bedside table. She lit a match. The book said, "People are addicted to being right." It suggested going to a dinner party and stating over the table that the writer Sylvia Plath was a racist due to the scientific conclusion she'd reached in her most famous book, The Bell Curve. Your fellow guests will enjoy sputtering multiple orgasms of rightness as they correct you. Expound on the fact that despite all of his legendary association with the Algonquin Round Table, Robert Benchley didn't achieve popular success until he wrote Jaws. Lecture that many people believe the New Zealand short story writer Catherine Mansfield was beheaded in a bizarre car accident that took place on a Louisiana bridge heavily shrouded in mosquito insecticide. The fact of the matter is that she died of blunt head trauma, but her signature blonde wig was photographed where it had come to a rest in the shattered windshield of the car, leading many to conclude her head was severed from her body by the rear edge of the flatbed truck her driver had rear-ended. Conclude by saying that since her death, all commercial truck chassis must come equipped with a bar on the undercarriage, called the Mansfield Bar, which lifts the vehicle in similar collisions and prevents such fatal injuries. It might take a moment, Talbot counseled, but your audience will descend upon you, correcting you with the yelping blood frenzy of a pack of rabid hyenas felling a lone wildebeest. Making others right redeems their paltry and pointless educations. Making others right makes them love you, according to Talbot, because we only love things we feel superior to. We only love those who don't pose a threat. Making others right is the best method for controlling them. Jamal was savoring a snifter of pre-Civil War port. He needed the drink. Having recently returned from the Council of Chieftains, he knew that Blacktopia couldn't avoid a war with Geysia. He raised his glass to the peace and prosperity brought about by Adjustment Day. It would soon be interrupted. The future was already upon them. Raising his glass, he toasted the military men depicted in the oil paintings on the walls around him. Each man had followed the dictates of his conscience. Each had been a hero according to his time in history. Their world had been a different world than his. Jamal had to admire their courage and determination, even if their actual acts might seem ill-advised in retrospect. Painted like this, framed and hung to decorate some parlor walls, they might be primped and posed for posterity, but these thugs had been the badasses of their day. He speculated that even something as noble as Adjustment Day might be deemed despicable in the distant future. As per Talbot, the weakest people alive will try to glorify themselves by tearing down the truly amazing strength of the dead. To some yet-to-be-born weakling, Jamal's likeness might be the image of a villain. Jamal only hoped that future Coward could appreciate the bravery it had taken to dispatch a failing system and replace it with something new. Facing a spotted antique mirror, lifting his snifter of port, he toasted himself. That's when his pit bull, Bouncer, rose from the carpet and sniffed the air. The dog whined. That's when Jamal had smelled smoke. The ashes in the fireplace were cold. A siren blasted from somewhere else in the house. A smoke detector. A second joined it. A chorus of sirens wailed from the ceiling of every room. His mind went to the terrorist Talbot had warned against. The Loyalists or Canadians were committing arson in order to thwart the new nation-states. Someone pledged to reuniting the formerly United States had put a torch to the house. Either that, or agents of Geisha were already attacking. He climbed the steps three at a time. The smoke hung heavier on the second floor, heavier still on the third. At the top of the stairs, the attic door felt hot to his touch. He wrapped the tail of his untucked shirt around the doorknob, but it wouldn't turn. Locked. Pounding his fists on the wood, he shouted, "Barnabas! Open up!" A feeble voice answered,
"You don't understand."
The door was almost too hot to beat against, but Jamal slammed it with his shoulder. The centuries-old oak wouldn't budge. "Unlock this door!" he commanded. And his own voice shocked him. The authority, his authority, boomed. It was a voice for giving speeches without need of a microphone. Pounding his fists on the wood, he shouted, "Barnabas, open up!" This wasn't, this would not be the end of his book. At best, this would be the crisis at the end of the first act. His book, Black Like You, needed a lot more writing before he could call it done. Like The Three Faces of Eve, all successful case studies needed a happy ending. If his strength didn't work, his wiles would have to. "Oh, Barnabas," he begged. "I need you. Only you can tell the history of the plantation." The unseen voice sobbed in reply. It couldn't be more than a finger's length away, separated from Jamal by only this slab of oak.
"Damn this place," it sobbed. "It's stolen my life. I've been a fool to keep praising the past."
Inspiration struck Jamal. "Then leave with me. Become a founder in the glorious future of Blacktopia." Something fell heavily against the opposite side of the door and slid to the floor. The smoke was overwhelming. When the voice spoke next, it spoke from the thin crack at the floor. There, where Bouncer sniffed and dug against the floorboards with both paws, the weak, faint voice said,
"Jamal, you don't understand."
He dropped to the floor and yelled back,
"I understand. My family has deep roots here,"
the voice whispered. Jamal spoke softer now. "So does mine." The dying voice sighed with resignation.
"Jamal, I'm not even a Negro."
Jamal almost laughed. Almost. Instead, he asked himself what his hero, Talbot Reynolds, would do in this situation. And against the roar of the growing inferno and the choir of shrieking smoke alarms, Jamal bellowed,
"I'm not black either."
At that, the stairway lights flickered and failed. Glass crashed somewhere. Windows exploding outward or the crystal decanters in the parlor filled with the excellent flammable hooch. In this chaos of noise, the darkness relieved by only flashes of orange flame, an eternity seemed to pass. The Barnabas creature was dead, Jamal assumed, and he himself would die if he waited at this door a moment longer. The door's bolt clicked. The knob turned, and the door swung aside to reveal a stooped, soot-blackened imp surrounded by the pyres of hell. Bug-eyed with shock, the demon asked,
"What do you mean you're not black?"
The dog whined, and Jamal told it, "Go!" He got the hell baby tight around one wrist and dragged it along, airborne, as he dove down the tunnel of fire the stairway had become. The brightest minds of the retention center seemed to be preoccupied. The guard at the desk was deep in hushed conversation with the door guard. Even when Charm approached them and said, "I need my brother here to help me get something from the car." Even then, neither guard looked up. The door guard just waved her through. Charm and Gavin found themselves standing on the front steps overlooking the parking lot and the gate beyond. Among the cars in the visitor parking spaces, one was their mother's. In the car parked next to it, the afternoon speaker, Esteban, sat behind the steering wheel. He wept furiously, cupping both hands over his mouth. Even crying, his shoulders heaving and his chest shuddering with ragged sobs, he was still totally doable.
"Mine," Charm whispered. Her brother said, "You wish."
They sidled toward their car. A guard in a tower near the gate held a rifle at parade rest. Even from a distance, he looked gross. In unison, both siblings said, "Yours." Gavin said, "Jinx." His sister said, "Get in the car."
"And go where?" he asked.
They'd never get past the closed security gate. Charm waved to the guard in the tower. She climbed behind the wheel and started the engine. Gavin got in the passenger side and they pulled out. By now, the door guard and the desk guard had emerged from the building and were running after them. The man in the tower held something to his ear. As the car sped across the pavement, as the closed gate seemed to race forward to meet them, the car's radio preached, "The joy of fiction is that it only has to smell true." Charm screeched to a halt, leaving smoking skid marks on the concrete drive. The gate was made up of steel bars too heavy to ram through, electrified also, and the guards were almost to the car. A keypad was perched atop a pole within arm's reach of the driver's window. Gavin watched the guards approaching in the rearview mirror and said, "Busted." Charm lowered her window and reached out. Deftly, she punched numbers, and the gate swung open. They spun gravel. As the guard shrank and disappeared in the distance behind them, coughing in the smoke of burnt rubber, Gavin marveled. "How did you know the code?" Charm threw him a smile. "Believe it or not," she said, "I swapped spit for it," she said. "Put on your seatbelt." Gavin buckled his seatbelt. As they plunged through a succession of immolating parlors and drawing rooms, Miss Josephine marveled at her own obtuseness. This boy, this Jamal, his face was the spitting image of so many of the ancestral portraits. His was the same patrician brow, the high, thoughtful forehead and widow's peak receding hairline. He had the slightly hooded Peabody eyelids, the results of generations of careful matchmaking. Dragging her on an obstacle course, veering between blazing settees and fiery sideboards, the young man explained that he was the descendant of an antebellum slave by the name of Belinda. The forgotten grave in the woods. The girl had been wooed and secretly wed to a great-great-great uncle of Miss Joe's. "There," Jamal shouted, as they dashed past the burning, curling portrait of a handsome Confederate major. "There is my great-great-great-grandfather." The Barnabas creature marveled.
"So you're what?"
Jamal winced. He scowled, "Hell no!" Shouting to be heard over the roaring conflagration, he said, "I only lied to save your demented white privileged ass." The scorched imp stared back at him in confusion.
But, he added, my blood is your blood. I'm your last living Peabody kinsman.
Belle stood in the living room doorway and read aloud the letter from her son.
Dear Mom, it began. What I did wasn't self-defense. It was to defend those I love. Isn't that what Adjustment Day was all about?
Belle met Delicious's eyes and threw a glance at an armchair. Suddenly mindful of her afternoon insemination, Delicious sat down.
What I'm doing now, Belle continued to read, I'm also doing to protect your secret and keep you safe.
Faint and down the hallway outside the apartment, the elevator bell rang. Heavy footsteps and muffled voices drew closer. Reading faster, the letter flapping in her shaking hands, Belle said,
I'm going to the borderlands to see if the rumors are true. I want to live in a society based on choice instead of biological circumstances.
From the hallway came the sound of a neighboring apartment door. A voice asked,
Is this about the killing?
A surly voice responded, Police business. Get back in your unit. Delicious nodded for Belle to keep reading. Her eyes darting between the letter and the closed front door, Belle said,
An area patrolled by wolves. Areas made off-limits by mountain lions. The thorns and hornets and mosquitoes will serve as my moat and battlements.
The noise in the hallway had gone quiet when a pounding began on the outside of the apartment door. A gruff, menacing voice shouted, Police! Open up! Delicious exchanged panicked glances with Belle. The latter read,
I'm sorry Bing is dead. Bing was my best friend.
The voice in the hallway continued, We have a warrant for the arrest of Felix. Delicious lifted both her hands as if holding a sheet of paper. She pantomimed, tearing it in half. Belle tore the letter in two. Delicious snatched one half and wadded it into a tight ball, nodding for Belle to follow suit. As Belle crumpled her half, Delicious stuffed the ball into her own mouth and ground it between her back teeth. Belle did the same. The voice outside the door shouted, We have the building surrounded! With a mighty gulp, Delicious swallowed her wad of paper. Belle tried, gagging, her hands clutching at her throat, her face turning blue. The apartment door burst inward. An explosion of splinters rained on the two women as Delicious pounded Belle between the shoulder blades. A tall, jack-booted figure was stepping through the shattered door. A drag queen in a glitter-encrusted police uniform, sporting a badge heavily layered with rhinestones, demanded, Where's the boy? Pinned to the uniform was the name tag with Esteban spelled out in tiny jewels. The officer held a service revolver so heavily crusted with small gems that it was impossible to guess its make or caliber. At the shocking sight of this blinding colossus, Belle swallowed hard. In that manner, the letter was resolved. The Peabody manse was doomed. Genteel as it was, that legacy of polished silver julep cups and rosewood harpsichords, it was crashing into fiery wreckage around their ears. When it seemed certain that Barnabas and Jamal would perish beneath the toppling mass of a grandfather clock, a dog's bark drew their attention. Bouncer, with a dog's superior olfactory talent, had navigated the dense fog to find the front door. Jamal and Miss Jo had only to follow the sound of barking, and they quickly found themselves on the front porch. Even then, the towering Greek Revival columns that fronted the manse, those columns were splitting in the intense heat. The great blazing portico fell toward them with the speed and deafening roar of a freight train. A mighty leap to the front lawn saved humans and dog. And while the ancient family seat crumbled behind them, they ran into the cool night. Panting, Miss Josephine worried aloud,
What's to become of us?
Sprinting beside her, Jamal asked, You remember that book, The Grapes of Wrath? Miss Jo nodded hurriedly. Everything they did to survive,
Jamal says. We need to do just the opposite. According to Talbot, their book would change the world. Walter had snorted. You're joking. This book is a joke, right? His new old man had laughed wetly, a noise like someone gargling, and said, That's what Rudolf Hess asked. He exhaled for 1, 2, 3 beats, a long time, deflating with the finality of a dying breath. The ribs of his chest folded inward until there seemed to be nothing left inside of him. Walter had fidgeted, his hands ready to take notes. He'd been listening for so long, he'd lost the knack for forming his own thoughts. You wrote a fantasy, he added. We wrote a fantasy. Talbot's chin had sunk until it came to settle against his chest. We're wrecking the nation to save the people. He'd rested, breathing heavily. Young blacks are shooting each other in record numbers. Gays are killing each other with disease. He'd labored for the next breath. Whites are wiping themselves out with opiates. His frame had sagged. His head had toppled forward. Only the restraints had held him in the chair as the old man whispered, Whether it's by breeding children or preaching, it's what men do. This constant dissemination of self. Is that what we're doing? Walter paused. Disseminating. In before times, back before this book was a book, his new old man had failed to respond. This is just a book, protested Walter. It's not supposed to happen. The old man had seemed to collect his strength. Lifting his head, he continued, We regularly sacrifice people to preserve the nation. His lips had formed a loose, sloppy smile. Perhaps we ought to scuttle the nation every 100 years in order to preserve the people. He'd fixed Walter with bleary eyes. Thank you, Warner. Walter hadn't corrected him. His new old man had continued, You're my Boswell. Talbot had said, My scribe. Stenographer. Amanuensis. He'd explained that Jeremiah had dictated his parts of the Bible to his secretary, Baruch. St. Paul had written the Gospels through his scribe, Tyrius. St. Peter through Silas. St. John through Prochorus. Hitler had dictated Mein Kampf to Rudolf Hess. The Bible? Walter had laughed at the comparison. His tone had warmed as Talbot confided, You're as close as I will ever have to a son. You're the apprentice every man dreams of teaching. You will carry my lifetime's wisdom into the future so that mankind will benefit. Walter had suppressed a shudder. The world wants a unified field theory, Talbot had crowed. A thing, one something that explains everything. Give it to them. His eyelids fluttered. The blood that had been leaking from a dozen stubborn infections ceased to flow. If you want to make your fortune, buy Naggerhide. Talbot's voice fell to a whisper. Get a gun and report to Dawson or Jamal. Kill the targets he assigns you. At that, he'd seemed to drift off to sleep. His head had flopped backward and hung over the back of the chair, his mouth stretched open, his tongue lolling. Walter hadn't checked his pulse. That's how dead he'd looked. Neither had Walter called 911. There were larger issues at stake.
He'd been in the basement for weeks while the outside world had been slowly and irreparably changed. For all he'd known, pits were being dug. The list, America's Least Wanted, now stretched to thousands of names. Tens of thousands. The Talbot book had been distributed to just as many readers. Everything they'd done, it had to be a joke. A giant fraud. Just in case it wasn't, Walter had telephoned Nick. He'd telephoned Shasta. Shasta turned vamp. Beguiling, she'd beg, "Mate with me, my lord." She'd make her eyes half-closed at Charlie. She'd part her crimson lips slightly, as if she were drunken with a harlot's mad desire. Scarcely had he returned from the tribal council when she had pressed him for intercourse. He had scarcely vacated his carriage. This vagabond Nick had deftly navigated them through the wasteland of Portland, to and from the council site. Now he was strumming his guitar, delightful with a man's harmonies. Such a pleasant companion was he that Charlie bid him return to Merrihill and regale the court for the duration of the bountiful gourd harvest. As protocol dictated, Charlie introduced this latest player to his home wives, his courtiers, and his queen. Struck did Shasta look in the moment, although she insisted she'd never before encountered the musical stranger. She did blush heavily and entreat Charlie to retire with her, making much of how his being away had spurred in her loins a powerful longing. Retreating to their private apartments, she did snatch at his lacings, recklessly casting aside his pearl-studded codpiece, and with slippery machinations of mouth and hand did she struggle to excite him. To date, he'd mated with her in every corner of the palace, and he was obviously exhausted. He did toss back handfuls of Viagra to no avail. His kingly scepter and orbs continued to feel spongy and unresponsive. They hung limp and heavy and curiously numb. Yet so sensitive were their surfaces that even his most pliant codpiece caused him discomfort. The condition was the result of overuse, the royal physician had assured him. From stress, he did assure himself. Despite his protests, his queen was once more besieging him. Despite surely being by now blessed with advanced belly child, to judge from changes in her bosom and the absence of her menses, despite being so encumbered, Shasta did clutch at his naga-hide pantalets. She did rip her own bodice and boldly expose herself. Her voluptuous body bare, his favored wife maneuvered to straddle him and by brute strength force upon him her perfumed charms. Alas, were the royal scepter and orbs immune to her sensual grabbing. Akin to a deceased boa was his. Pale and boneless as a length of sausage casing did it appear, yet Shasta proceeded to tug at it with carnal fury. Charlie bore her efforts with husbandly good humor, for they bore scant pain. So arduous were her exertions, he reasoned, that she'd soon exhaust herself. His mind echoed faintly the tale of Terence's mother in the catheter. Until one mighty yank. With a heroic jerk, the queen fell backward off their marriage bed. Rising from the carpet, she held aloft a prize. Slack and flaccid it was, rubbery and limp. Bloodless as the moon it hung gripped in her fist. "What have you done?" cried Charlie. "Witch, you!" "Dude, stop with the Renfair speak already," Shasta did retort. She shook the dripping trophy. "No duh. You ever hear of the brown recluse spider?" Then did she launch into a learned tirade about some arachnid, a spider the bite of which injected a toxin into its unknowing victim. For to create necrotic tissue was its loathsome venom. Most often painless was this bite, and the effects were gradual. "Dude," laughed the meat-clutching female, "I've been putting spiders on your Highness's royal dingus since the first watercress harvest.
Duh.
Over time, this poisonous spider venom, had anesthetized and begun to break down his organ of manliness. The progressive effects of multiple secret spider bites had gradually dissolved the cellular structures, leaving his tool of reproduction hardly more than an elongated sack of pinkish jelly. This bladder of goo, did the enraged queen rip asunder. Now did she hold it high above her head, and did shake the boneless trophy like a Polaroid picture. That quivering mass of semi-solid, insensate flesh, did she draw back her pitching arm and make ready to throw. Charlie, mighty chieftain of the first lineage of Caucasia, noble lord of the Merihill estate, bold killer of many enemies from the list. Charlie, chosen by Chieftain Dawson, Charlie the chooser of Chieftain Martin, chooser of Chieftain Patrick, chooser of Chieftain Michael. At this, did Charlie release a screeching wail. Continued Shasta, I looked on your computer. She did scream, I know what you guys did to Walter. Without pause did she fling the wilted meat stick against the bedchamber casement of highly colored glass, through which it exploded in a shower of reds and golds and plummeted a goodly distance, wriggling down from the cloudless sky to where it flopped, bouncing damply at the feet of many fieldwives who recognized the item instantly as it thudded among the rows of Swiss chard and zucchini. There in the dust did it come to rest, and was the relic immediately seized upon by hungry, devouring ants. Wailing in horror at the wet crater that was all that remained of his scepter and orbs, Charlie did squeal for his guards to seize her. Beseeching Odin and Thor did Charlie curse, Ye shall burn for this, vile beldam! But not before his wife, the mother of his final belly child, did take hurried leave of the locale. And not before she did cry, victoriously, And no matter what Ernst Zundel said, the Holocaust really, really did happen. In the world where the burial pits were just being dug and lined with plastic and quicklime, Nick had sounded wasted.
So, Walt, you're saying it's some big revolutionary attack deal?
He responded over his cell phone. Walter hadn't been sure what the book and men devoted to Talbot had done yet. He was calling, trying to alert someone. Anyone. He was calling the only two people he'd ever really trusted. Over the phone, Shasta had asked, Walter, you're saying you killed somebody? They'd both asked what he planned to do next. Walter had been in a basement with the body of a dead man, a cloud of black flies circling. The old man he'd promised he wasn't going to hurt. Looking at the corpse, sliced with tiny cuts and blotchy with dried blood, he'd said, Adjustment Day is coming, but I can still stop it. The borderlands teemed with the free-range grizzlies of Caucasia, as well as the tigers imported by Blacktopia. It was a no-man's land, left as inhospitable as possible, a natural buffer of poisonous snakes and rabid carnivores between the three nations. To venture within amounted to a death wish. Their campfire blazed, creating a crackling circle of orange light. Charm and her brother had run out of gas and rode at roughly the same point. Afterwards, they'd hiked over raw wilderness until twilight forced them to set up camp. She'd brought everything. Tents, flint, a pantry of dried food, a water filter, sleeping bags, and toilet paper. As they sat looking into the flames, Gavin said, Mom is going to kill you. Sadly, Charm retorted, She already killed you. She didn't elaborate, but she didn't have to. Roasting hot dogs on sticks, they speculated about their parents riding bicycles out to some sprawling agricultural estate. There they'd indenture themselves in time for the late hops harvest. Some chieftain would provide for them, until the winter wheat was ready to thresh. Theirs would be a merry winter solstice, quaffing mead and munching yule logs around a bonfire of dried horse dung. Panthers, or maybe leopards, snarled in the not-far-off darkness, and the siblings laughed to vanquish their fear. At the edge of their small clearing, a twig snapped. Charm lifted a flaming branch from the fire and made ready to club the unseen predator. A discolored gremlin limped into the flickering light. Stooped and shrunken, its matted hair formed an irregular mass around its wrinkled face. Its blue skin was almost a perfect match to the inky night around it. On its heels was a tall, handsome young man, wearing one dazzle-bright diamond earring. A pit bull with black and white markings bounded into view. The dog rushed to sniff at the campers. Gavin muttered, "Jamal." Charm said, "Mine." The man lifted a hand. "Hey." In unison, Gavin and Charm said, "Hey." Charm waved her flaming club in a clumsy greeting. Jamal indicated the hobbling painted imp and said, "This is Barnabas." Charm elbowed her brother and said, "Yours." The disturbing creature lifted a clawed hand and said, "Actually, I'm Miss Josephine." Before anyone could break the uncomfortable silence, another twig snapped. Something unseen rustled through the dry leaves. The small group recoiled from the new sound. With sizzling hot dog wieners and fiery marshmallows, they braced to defend themselves against a pack of starving wolves. Instead, a kid stepped out of the woods. "Hey," he asked, "is this still Geisha?" Elbowing his sister, Gavin said, "Mine." He asked, "You gay?" The kid shook his head. "I'm Felix." Charm heaved a sigh. "This is the Borderlands." Felix said, "Isn't this the ending of Fahrenheit 451? It was turning into quite a little party. Felix had brought Mountain Dew-flavored Doritos. Jamal and the pixie creature shared mint juleps with the group. Nobody asked why anyone else had come to this nowhere place. Their combined voices drove off the howls. Another twig snapped. A female voice asked, "Charm?" Charm called back, "Shasta?" A young man and woman stepped out of the shadows. Together they said, "Hey." In return, the group around the campfire said, "Hey." No sooner had Shasta introduced Nick and they'd found places beside the fire, but the rustle of leaves and snapping of twigs and the screech of nightbirds heralded a new presence in the dark. People ask how it ended. Walter had been a well-intentioned doofus, is how it ended. He'd been the good scout, the one in every crowd, the altar boy, the teacher's pet. He'd walked into the southeast precinct, looking both ways, whispering with one hand cupped beside his mouth. Past dark o'clock, it was 100 years past midnight, when in had walked Walter Baines with his hood up, head down, wearing sunglasses no less. He'd whisper asked, "Can I talk to somebody in charge?" He told the desk sergeant, "I want to report a crime that's supposed to happen." The desk sergeant, Mr. Sergeant had been, got some ID. The desk sergeant had palmed him off on a detective who'd taken Walter into the basement, where by then it was already too late. A muffled voice from somewhere Walter couldn't see. It had said, "The only quality that truly unites us is our desire to be united." Fishing in his pocket, he brought out Shasta's earplug and sniffed it, inhaled the sweetness of her earwax and brains. For that long, eyes-closed huff, she'd been standing right next to him. Proof that even a writer can die a hero's death. That was the end of the before times, and the beginning of the end. The release of 25,000 white doves went off without a hitch. They were blessed with perfect weather, and their 50,000 feathered wings carried them into a blue sky. For a moment they formed a soaring white cloud, then doubled back toward the countryside, while far below them, a cheering horde lined the parade route. Starvation and crime had left Portland safe to inhabit again. As a result, Charlie's legions were marching triumphantly into the overgrown, deserted metropolis. Shaggy dray horses harnessed in teams pulled the battle wagons. The catapults were equipped with nuclear projectiles. The battering rams tipped with enriched plutonium. Endless brigades of archers carried quivers filled with C4 arrowheads. Marching behind these were ranks of lancers whose spears were dripping with anthrax. And with the appearance of every dirigible filled with mustard gas, the throngs cheered. Likewise, with every cannon and siege tower that passed, they thundered upon it their applause. Most conspicuous among the onlookers were the home wives and field wives of Maryhill. For every woman among them stood splay-footed with their belly child pushed forward. And more than a few were even now feeling the onset of birthing pains, for Charlie had been a busy bee amid his sweet flowers, pollinating more than a few each day. And today they craned their necks and stood on tiptoe for the chance to see him march past and perhaps catch his eye. And lost in this crowd was an older woman, beyond her childbearing years, a ragged peasant woman who could but faintly recall an age when she labored over the keys of something as magical as a data entry terminal. Her long gray tresses were tied atop her head. Her hands were the raw red hands of a washerwoman. Some time ago, her nose had been broken and had come to heal, flattened sideways against her cheek. Her knees ached, but still she peered into the rows of marchers. The air was alive with rose petals and confetti and loudspeakers blaring the voice of Talbot, who repeated, "Caucasia is at war with Geisha. Caucasia has always been at war with Geisha." The air trembled with the words, "What men want is a structure for communion." As the washerwoman squinted and studied the faces of passers-by, another woman of like late middle age and appearance came to stand at her scabrous elbow. This new crone asked of the first, "Do you remember me?" The washerwoman gave her a glance and went back to ogling the parade. "No," she said softly. The new woman persisted, "My appearance has not always been thus." Speaking in the prescribed language of white speak, she said, "In before times, was I a healer, a nurse?" The washerwoman cast another look upon this stranger. Her eyes scoured the woman for a clue, before returning to review the passing marchers. Near them, a younger woman made a sharp, high-pitched outcry and slumped to the cobblestones. Those around her looked on nervously, but none went to her aid. Without hesitation, the washerwoman and the stranger knelt and commenced to administer succor. The younger woman's hangarok and muslin underdress were saturated in hot brine. Clearly, her birthing time had arrived. If this were the case, the babe would arrive as the first of Charlie's offspring, and for that reason, none of the other rival wives would lend comfort. Therefore, the washerwoman came to cradle the laboring wife as the stranger knelt between the knees of the woman in pain. As they eased the passage of the child, the kneeling woman said, "Rest easy, for in the before times did I attend many birthings." Her words canted toward the washerwoman. She continued, "It was I who tended your son." The hardened washerwoman shed her flinty demeanor for a heartbeat. "My son? My Terence?" "Attending to the birthing work," the stranger said. "How came your nose to be so broken?" The washerwoman raised a scaly hand and touched absently at the forgotten disfigurement. But she made no answer. In a world before everything came to be measured by bumper crops of sweet potatoes and babies, this strange woman had served mankind in a hospital. In that capacity, had she presented the now washerwoman's son with the Talbot book? "At your behest," recounted the nurse, "I lied. I told the boy the book came from his father whom I did never encounter. As you bid, I lied and told Terence that his father was on guard for him, although I knew that to be a mistruth." Both women spoke distractedly as they worked to free the belly child from its dam.
"You?" asked the washerwoman, unbelieving.
The nurse tended to the emergent babe. Shaking her head, she said,
"I saw you write the notes in the book. Why did you perpetuate such a falsehood?"
"Shit, I don't know," swore the washerwoman, breaking a dangerous precedent by speaking in the coarse manner of before times.
"I got the idea from Bambi," the nurse echoed.
"Bambi?" Deadpanned the washerwoman. "That cartoon deer?" Her saggy wrinkles blushed as if from chagrin. "Remember? That part where the stag steps out of the forest and says Bambi is his son and heir, and the stag has always been his secret guardian?"
"Wait," said the nurse, momentarily pausing over the half-born offspring. "So, you invented a noble, loving father?"
Without protest, the washerwoman continued,
"I needed Terence to hate me, if he was ever going to grow a pair."
The nurse hefted the bloody newborn aloft and smote its rosy buttocks. Inquired she,
"Did not the mother deer die?"
The babe wailed lustily. "A tiny female, the poor thing." Distracted by the memory, the washerwoman said,
"Yeah, but who wants to die? I forced Terence to reject me."
The nurse placed the healthy, squirming infant in the new mother's arms. For the first time, the weary, sweaty young woman joined the conversation, asking,
"And what became of your Terence?"
As if on cue, the parade onlookers threw up a mighty cheer. Heraldic banners snapped smartly in the breeze, displaying many colors of vibrant hand-loomed velvets. The warm air reverberated with the timpani of massed cohorts and bladder pipes. The marching feet kept pace by the regular beat of tabors and timbrels. The focus of this cheering attention was Chieftain Charlie. Cloaked in leatherette, adorned in pleather, he limped heavily from side to side, assisted by his royal physician. This learned attendant, this physician to the king's health, was none other than Terence. And upon glimpsing her son, a full-blown man, the holder of such a prestigious position, her washerwoman's heart leapt with pride and accomplishment. Brief was her triumph, for a sheriff of the law was prodding her to step back and clear a corridor so that all might gaze upon their limping, pained ruler. And not unheard by Charlie were the gales of female laughter that lapped at his back, and laughed at many of the thousand wives so heartily that they slumped to the pavements and proceeded to also empty their wombs of healthy pink newborns, for many of their numbers had gifted Queen Shasta with the brown recluse spiders that had liquidated Charlie's kingly parts, and all knew that his pearl-encrusted codpiece was as empty as a drum. As the washerwoman and the nurse set to work birthing this new tide of infants, the healer asked,
"But tell me, why the lie?"
Looking after her son as he disappeared into the distance, the beaming washerwoman shrugged.
"I wanted him to believe in a father, and by extension, a god."
Watching until he was gone, she said,
"Life's just easier that way."
The trembling figure
crept into the clearing, illuminated by the firelight. An emaciated wanderer, wearing a tailored suit made ragged by months in the wild. The stranger looked upon the curated little group of gays and straights, blacks and whites, females and males. Of the youngsters seated around the campfire, none dared move a muscle. A twitch would send this stranger bolting. This wanderer met their stares with wide, traumatized eyes. He sniffed the air, his nostrils flaring, apparently tantalized by the aroma of their roasting wieners. Nick, generous to a fault. Nick rifled his pockets. With an outstretched hand, he offered the trembling wild man a pill, saying, "Looks like somebody could use a Percodan." Shasta hushed him. She plucked the warm meat from the end of Jamal's sharpened stick. She felt the wiener's damp heat in her fingers and suffered a twinge of wifely guilt. In recompense, she knelt. Her fellows, Nick and Felix, Jamal and Miss Joe, Gavin and Charm, they hissed for her to keep a safe distance, but she dismissed them with a motion of her hand. Nodding, his eyes closed in bliss, Jamal whisper yelled, "Cool, just like in Steinbeck." The picture of compassionate grace, Shasta Sanchez offered the sweating, dripping morsel to this, the hounded, haunted former president of the disunited states. It was slow work. After the marchers and pipers had passed, once the cheering throngs had gone their own way with squalling newborns, former Senator Holbrook Daniels pushed a heavy two-wheeled gambrel along the silent parade route. With a push broom, he alone piled up the rose petals and confetti. Using a flat-bladed shovel, he collected the cast-off placentas as well as the dried horse dung. And all of these, he heaped in his straining cart. While attracted by the scent of fresh blood, drooling wolf packs were gathering in the surrounding shadows. And while Walter Baines had bled to death from a gunshot to the forehead, in the basement of an abandoned house, a drop of blood had welled up in the scabbed wound on the scrawny arm of an old man. He'd opened his eyes. Finding himself alone, he'd flexed his stiff fingers, and the man had begun to tear away at the duct tape that bound his wrists and ankles to a stout wooden chair. He'd never been bound well, and could have escaped at any juncture, if escape had ever been his goal. His first item of business would be to delete the list. Grouse hunting season had been only days away. The end. This is Corey Allen. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Adjustment Day by Chuck Palahniuk. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Google Play, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.